WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. The so-called shopping cart killer will undergo more psychological testing before he is sentenced. Governor Spanberger blames President Trump for higher gas prices, and she says voting for redistricting will help rein him in. And a book written by a Harrisonburg educator more than a century ago is brought to life on stage at the Virginia Festival of the Book. This is the WMRA Daily for Monday, March 23rd. The man convicted of killing two women in Harrisonburg and transporting their bodies in a shopping cart is undergoing neuropsychological testing ahead of sentencing, which has been scheduled for May. WMRA's Randy B. Hagee reports.
Anthony Eugene Robinson, dubbed the shopping cart killer by law enforcement, was convicted last January of murdering Aileen Beth Redman and Tanita Larice Smith in a motel room in Harrisonburg. The jury recommended he be given four life sentences plus 10 years and a $400,000 fine. A judge will ultimately decide his sentence. One of Robinson's two attorneys, public defender Abigail Tebow, has said she plans to argue the judge could choose to suspend part of a life sentence, even in an aggravated murder case. Robinson is also wanted in another murder case in Washington, D.C., and suspected of killing two more women in Fairfax. The Rockingham Circuit Court previously appointed the UVA Forensic Clinic at the Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy to conduct a neuropsychological evaluation of Robinson in light of his previous mental illness diagnoses and low grade point average while in school. Tebow appeared in court on Friday to argue that the evaluators needed to be in a contact room with Robinson to finish their testing, which includes activities such as passing him small objects like blocks and pencil and paper. But the Rockingham County Sheriff, Brian Hutchison, only allows inmate visits conducted through a glass barrier. Tebow asked the court for an exception to this rule at the local jail or for Robinson to be transferred to Middle River Regional Jail in Verona, which does allow contact visits. Judge Bruce D. Albertson denied the defense's motion. He added the evaluators can still testify about their findings without getting a contact visit with Robinson. His sentencing hearing is currently scheduled for May 22nd. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
We've posted a longer version of this report with more details at WMRA.org and on our app. Governor Abigail Spanberger voted in favor of a mid-decade redistricting effort on Friday. She also highlighted the cost of gas, blamed the increase on the president, and said a yes vote on redistricting would help combat his actions. Radio IQ's Brad Kuttner reports.
Governor Abigail Spanberger didn't mince words when it came to increasing gas prices.
Gas is about to hit $4 a gallon because the President of the United States unilaterally, without approval from Congress, without any real engagement with the American people, let alone congressional oversight, decided to launch a war against Iran that has now spread to the broader Middle East. The fact that gas prices are going up astronomically was totally and completely foreseeable.
Spanberger made the comments after voting yes for Virginia Democrats' effort to redraw congressional lines to favor their party. She linked her vote to concerns about President Donald Trump's efforts nationally.
This amendment is temporary. And responsive to this moment in time where we have a president who has gone to other states seeking additional congressional seats, saying he's, quote, entitled to them.
Brian Cannon, with the vote no campaign, no gerrymandering Virginia, said Virginians already decided how to draw lines long before Trump took office.
Some states are choosing to gerrymander, other states are not. Experts say it's probably going to be a wash as to which party comes out ahead, and Virginia doesn't need to be a part of that toxic race to the bottom.
Voting in the redistricting referendum continues through April 21st. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Governor Spanberger has called a special session for April 23rd so state lawmakers can vote on a budget. The General Assembly ended its 2026 legislative session on March 14th without agreeing on a final spending plan for the next fiscal year. One key issue has been whether to keep a tax break that helps the data center industry save billions. The Commonwealth needs a finalized budget by June 30th to avoid a government shutdown. Meanwhile, the governor has a slate of immigration bills to consider. They could reshape the state's relationship with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Karis Manzanares with partner station VPM reports.
Virginia state lawmakers approved bills that restrict 287G agreements by limiting how and when law enforcement may perform federal immigration functions. These bills shift the warrants standard to requiring court approval before someone can be detained. Law enforcement agencies also have to meet several conditions before entering or continuing agreements with ICE. Democratic delegate Alfonso Lopez, who carried the House bill, said these protections will clarify the roles and responsibilities of local police.
Because they address community safety, community trust, and fundamental constitutional rights of due process. And it's about relieving the fear that exists in some new American and immigrant communities.
Other bills prohibit detentions at courthouses and schools and limits law enforcement's ability to shield their identities.
Harris Manzanares reporting. Disabled Virginians under guardianship may be able to vote under a new law waiting for Governor Spanberger's signature. Republicans criticized the effort, but advocates say that Virginia will join dozens of other states in allowing the right. Brad has the details.
We should not have incapacitated people that don't know what's going on around them voting.
That's Amherst County Republican Delegate Tim Griffin speaking against an effort by Fairfax area Democrat Delegate Kathy Tran that would ask courts to make an additional finding, one of their competency to vote when someone is put under guardianship. Here's Tran.
That maybe they can't take care of their financial responsibilities on their own. Maybe they're not able to make their medical decisions. But to recognize their humanity and to see if they still have that ability and the capacity to have a voice in our democracy.
According to the American Bar Association, Virginia isn't the only state that forbids voting by those under a guardianship, but it's among the few states with no exceptions to the rule. Democrats sent the same bill to former Governor Glenn Youngkin last year, but he cited a section of the Virginia Constitution that says, quote, no person adjudicated to be mentally incompetent shall be qualified to vote until his competency has been reestablished, when he vetoed the effort. Advocates for the disabled community say it's a wrong that's long been in need of correction. Tanya Milling is with the ARC of Virginia. While she understands philosophical debate on the issue, she said sweeping bans rob those under guardianship of any political voice.
There are many kinds of decisions that we make in life, medical, financial, and it doesn't mean that we're not able to look at this issue and make the decision that's important to us.
The effort got some Republican support in the Senate before it was sent to the governor's desk. Spanberger has until April 13 to sign, veto, or amend the measure. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
The governor is considering a bill that would help people getting out of prison avoid crippling debt. Michael Pope explains.
Humanization Project co-founder Taj Mahan Heft says people who are incarcerated often feel like getting out of prison seems like the end. But he says it's just the beginning, and it's often one that's slammed with debt from the court system. Not restitution, but a variety of fines and fees that courts assess for everything from having a jury trial to processing paperwork.
What that leads to is a greater likelihood that you're going to feel the need to do something illegal to pay that debt to avoid being violated and potentially getting in trouble and having to stay either under supervision or reincarcerated. It will also lead to predatory lenders being an option that feels like the only thing available, which creates a cycle that impacts not just the individual coming home, but their families.
That's why he's excited about a bill now on the governor's desk that would limit the statute of limitations on that debt, which is currently 60 years in circuit court and 30 years in general district court. The bill would limit all that debt to 10 years. Here's Cami Blatt at the Commonwealth Institute.
We have other ways that we can fund our criminal legal system, not off the backs of those who have the least and relying on folks to commit crimes and continue getting entrenched in the system to fund the system. We need to find other revenue sources in Virginia to fund our courts.
The previous governor vetoed a similar bill, but the current governor has until April 13th to take action on this one. I'm Michael Pope.
Virginia's attorney general has joined a lawsuit to block a multi-billion-dollar broadcast media merger. Whitney Evans with partner station VPM reports.
Jay Jones says the Nexstar Media Group and Tegna merger, federally approved on Thursday, will harm consumers by putting power over local news in the hands of fewer people. The new company would own 265 television stations in 44 states and the District of Columbia, according to the Federal Communications Commission, most of them local ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC affiliates.
although Nexstar has committed to divesting six of those stations, including Wavy TV and Hampton Roads. The FCC says the merger empowers local broadcast TV to compete with national broadcast networks. Jones argues the merger violates federal law by reducing competition. In order to approve the merger, the FCC waived its own rule that bars a single company from owning more than 39% of U.S. television households.
Whitney Evans reporting. Finally today, Harrisonburg educator and author George Newman's novel was published more than a century after it was originally written. Over the weekend, the book was brought to life in a staged reading at the Virginia Festival of the Book. WMRA's Kate Bean reports.
One of the novels being highlighted is A Miserable Revenge, A Story of Life in Virginia, written by George Newman. Born a free man in Winchester, Newman went on to become a leader and educator in Harrisonburg's African-American community. Kalayla Williams, the director of the Virginia Center for the Book, attended a symposium at James Madison University last year when A Miserable Revenge was published for the first time.
George Newman is a revolutionary figure because during this time period, he sat down and penned a whole manuscript, not to mention the work that he did during his lifetime, aside from writing the manuscript, being an educator, being a businessman, owning property. These were revolutionary acts for a black man in the 1870s.
By his early 20s, he was principal of the Effinger Street School in Harrisonburg. Outside of his career in education, Newman served as a U.S. Marshal during the Prohibition era, owned an insurance company, and was a minister and civic leader. It was between his time as an educator and a U.S. Marshal that he began writing A Miserable Revenge. The novel is inspired by real elements of Newman's life growing up as an apprentice in the 1840s and as a community leader post-Civil War. The story is set in the antebellum period and features a complex web of characters who find themselves caught up in a chain of betrayal and corruption. The handwritten manuscript was rediscovered by Newman's granddaughter, Ruth Tolliver, who brought it to Tiffany Cole on the James Madison University Special Collections team.
I'd read a bit and I'd go, oh my goodness, this is unbelievable. You know, I don't believe this. And I'd say to myself, and this is a man who basically was self-taught. I kind of thought to myself, it needs to be published. And that stayed in my mind for a long time because I didn't know what to do with it.
Tolliver's intention in bringing the manuscript to JMU was simply to have it preserved digitally. Cole reached out to Dr. Molly Godfrey, Director of Graduate Studies, to help with the project.
We reached right out to Ruth and asked her if she was comfortable with us getting them transcribed. She was thrilled.
Newman's manuscript makes literary history as the earliest known example of a white life novel, one written by a black author that centralizes white characters and storylines.
His relationship to the genre is a little ambiguous. There's definitely evidence that he is critiquing white society and the white South in this novel, but there's also some suggestion that he's trying to write himself into what were quite popular genres for white authors and white readers at the time. He's kind of writing himself into the Western and the mystery and the detective novel and plantation fiction.
The transcription was mainly completed by graduate students Evan Sizemore and Jeslyn Poole, who navigated challenges ranging from grammar mistakes to missing or torn pages. One of these torn pages includes the final page of the story, leaving the complete ending unknown.
I cried when I got a copy of it. I just cried. I thought, you know, I only wish that he could see his work in print. Of his grandchildren, I'm the only living grandchild. Now, there are some great-grandchildren and some great-greats.
Tolliver was 11 years old when her grandfather passed away, and this novel has helped her feel closer to him. Much of his love was displayed in a beautiful garden he built, just for her and her sister to play in and explore.
I do remember his laugh, and if something was funny, he just let go and laughed about it. But there was just something about him that drew me to him. I've got chills running through me. You know, just thinking of him as a person and realizing that he had space in that garden for my sister and me, but he had an impact on me that I'll keep forever.
For WMRA News, I'm Kate Bean.
There is a longer version of this report with more details at WMRA.org and on our app. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy your Monday.